the heavy lifting with the PowerPoint. I'm going to stand up here. Can you all hear me well? And everybody, those of you who are standing at the back should know that there are all these lovely empty seats toward the front. Okay, good. You always feel a little strange when people just sort of float toward the back and don't want to come near. I wanted to start with this, even though this is not the title of today's presentation. This is the title of the overall study and the final report. And so if you are looking for it, we'll give you at the end a way to access it and a variety of other information online. But I wanted to show you both so that you would see that title, but also to see symbolically the extent of collaboration that was involved in this study. Because not only were all these organizations and agencies involved, but in addition, clearly, survivors and advocates who are working in the field. So this is the official title slide of today's presentation. So wanted to give you a quick overview, even though Mary Louise has just done a little bit of the overview, because clearly it was a highly collaborative effort. It did involve both the National Resource Center and the University of Connecticut working directly on the study, but also collaboration with domestic violence coalitions and advocates across the country. You've already heard about the funding, but we worked with coalitions and programs in 8 states, which I'll detail in a moment. Just a quick little bit of background. We did provide training to the coalitions at a meeting in Atlanta in July. They were all present. That was one of their opportunities to provide feedback, and we did make some modifications as a result of their feedback. But then that training presentation in PowerPoint was then given to each of the 8 state coalitions so that they in turn could use it to provide training to the participating programs in their state. We did maintain ongoing connection through a variety of mechanisms. We provided biweekly reports back to each of the states so that they knew how many results were coming in and from which of their programs. So all of that coordination, we were also providing technical assistance throughout the study. There were 2 forms that were involved, one that was completed at around entry by survivors and another at exit, and I'll explain that in a bit more in a moment. One of the things that we're particularly proud of is that all materials that survivors saw were translated into 11 languages. Those were the languages that were identified by the coalitions as those non-English languages that were most commonly spoken by the survivors who came to their programs. We also had a contract with the National Hotline so that people who were unable to complete a written form in their language other than English, we could involve their access to translation services in, I don't know how many languages they have accessible to them, but it's a massive number. So we did a great deal to try to enhance participation and access to this study. Mary Louise described some of the goals, but these more precisely were the goals for this study. It's basically a descriptive study. It's not a controlled experimental design. And what we wanted to know was about the experiences of a diverse sample of domestic violence survivors in residential shelter programs. I need to underline in residential shelter programs right now. This is not a study that included people who were staying in safe homes or who were provided safety through motels or through other means in their communities, but these were the regular residential shelter programs. We also wanted to learn more about what survivors want when they come to programs and the extent to which they get what they want. We wanted to learn about how their experiences and how their needs might vary across demographic and program characteristics. And we also hope to be able to develop recommendations for programs about improving services. This shows you something about the participation that we obtained. These are the 8 states. You'll see that we have 2 states from each of the major geographic regions of the country. We have 2 from the west, 2 from the north central, 2 from the south central, and 2 from the east. In all, there were 215 programs that participated in the study, which was a response rate of available programs in those 8 states of 81%. There were some individual programs that were participating in other studies or had other pressures upon them at that time, and so they declined to participate. States were clearly selected to maximize the diversity of programs and survivors so that it would be as representative as possible. Clearly something that involves a pure random design under these circumstances would be incredibly difficult to accomplish, particularly if you have voluntary participation of survivors in the shelter programs. So in this way, we were able to vary by geographic region, by the type of economy. We had communities with very, very much concentrations on high-tech kinds of industries, as well as agricultural, as well as industrial. The rural-urban combination, I think, was well represented, and we were able to obtain good representation of the racial ethnic diversity in the programs in the states involved. The coalition contacted the staff members in each program and requested their participation, and then, as I said, provided the monitoring. A description of our instruments, and I should say that, as Mary Louise indicated, these instruments were revised over time, beginning in 1998, working with researchers, state administrators, survivors, and advocates, both local and state level, over time, and were pilot tested in 4 states before this study was conducted. So we felt pretty confident in the utility and the comprehensiveness, at least for these questions, of these particular instruments. Shelter 1, as we refer to it, was offered within 48 hours of entry. It was clearly not administered while a new resident was in crisis, and it includes a wide variety of kinds of information in 2 short pages, because we were also not wanting to burden survivors with excessive involvement in answering questions. The staff had guidelines for how to talk to each of the survivors about their participation in the study. They were given an information sheet, again translated into all those languages that explained that this was voluntary participation. And so all of that was included for both Shelter 1 and Shelter 2. It also covers the needs, survivors' needs, and the help that they wanted, in addition to these other issues. Shelter 2 was given when a resident showed signs of leaving or at the time when most residents usually left. If any of you, and I should ask that, how many of you are advocates or work in shelters? Any of you? Okay. Well, those of you in particular will know that there is often not a planned exit moment, that sometimes survivors in shelters simply leave in the middle of the night, and that's why we had this kind of guideline. If there was a sort of, if most people in their shelter stayed for a month, they would be asked to complete it again at about the 1-month point, and then if they knew when they were about to leave. They were asked to complete it again, and then the interim form was eliminated from the study. But sometimes survivors give signs, like they're making arrangements for housing that they're going to return to, or they're organizing transportation, or they're organizing other kinds of things that are consistent with leaving, and so that would be an indication as well. Shelter 2 includes the number of days they'd spent, the same demographics, their experiences and their outcomes, very short-term, immediate, self-reported outcomes, and then the extent to which they had obtained the services that they had wanted. Those are the that's the information we obtained from survivors. We also obtained information from programs. Each program completed an information sheet that asked about the services that they provided, the kinds of advocacy that they provided, something about their staff background, the accessibility to the shelter, and a variety of other questions. And then we also obtained census information about the county in which the shelter was located, because very often people are drawn to a shelter, not necessarily from a specific town, but from a larger area. Want to emphasize some of the safety and confidentiality precautions that we took. Each program was assigned a code number by the coalition. The coalition maintained the record of the link between the program number and the program location. When we received the completed forms, it had the number on it of the program, but we had no idea which program the survivor was coming from. We did know the state, but we did not know which program. Each resident created their own personal ID. We provided a suggestion as a way to do that, but also allowed them to vary it if they wanted to use some other mechanism, if that made them feel like they were more easily identifiable. And that enabled us to link the Shelter 1 with the Shelter 2 and without compromising the identity. I mean, we didn't even know which program they came from. We also, residents were provided with pre-address stamped envelopes so they could send surveys directly to the research staff. And again, the staff received written guidelines for implementing this entire process. So it was very clear that they did not complete the form in the presence of a staff member. They did not hand their survey back to a staff member. They had another repository location. We're getting to the results in a second, but this is all important stuff to understand as a background. So we, as I said, we had 215 programs. The average number of staff was 16 and a half, but the range was dramatic. So we could have reported a median, but we reported the average here. But it ranged from 1.25 staff to 99. So we had tiny rural programs participating and very large urban programs as well. You can see that the average number of volunteers was 15. Average capacity as far as beds, you can see again a dramatic range between 4 and 102. The average number of adults ranged from 2 to 2,300. That's clearly one of those larger programs. And the average number of children, the range was 1 to 1,242. So we had some very, very busy programs as well as some much smaller programs. We asked about the language capacity of the staff in the programs, and this is the list. 36 different languages were spoken by staff in these 215 programs. Clearly, the larger the program, the more likely the staff were to speak a language other than English. I can say 82% of those programs had at least one person who spoke a language other than English, and 72% spoke Spanish of the total, had someone who spoke Spanish. Looking at the program services offered by the shelters, 98% reported that they could accommodate at least one kind of disability, and the most common clearly were physical disabilities, but over 80% could accommodate hearing disabilities, and then slightly less than that, visual disabilities, and had other mechanisms as well. Of 9 different types of advocacy that we asked about, the percentage of the programs that offered those ranged from 95% to 73%. Housing was the most common kind of advocacy, followed by, and I don't highlight that here, but for this audience I should, 82% had civil court advocates, 81% had criminal court advocates as part of their program. Divorce issues were least common, with 73%. So you can see that a wide variety of advocacy was offered. And of the 6 different types of services that we asked about, the range was 97% who offered support groups to 50% who offered childcare. The 4 in between are crisis counseling, individual counseling, parenting classes, and child counseling. So those are the ones that fall in between support groups and childcare. Okay, we get to now to the survivors themselves. We did not have all of the survivors complete both forms, as you can see, and you see that breakdown. 565 completed both Shelter 1 and Shelter 2, and when we did a comparison of that group with the others, they were remarkably similar. There were no statistically significant differences between those two groups. There was a slight tendency, interestingly, for those with less than an 8th grade education to have completed both forms. So it was quite contrary to some of our notions that, well, it's only the college-educated folks that are going to participate in a study kind of thing. So we felt pleased about that. But if you put those numbers together, you end up with 2,446 who completed Shelter 1 and 1,429 who completed Shelter 2. I'm going to give you a quick overview of some of the background demographic characteristics. You can see just slightly over half are white or are Caucasian, and the remainder are people of color, 22% African American, and you can read those. Although you don't have a handout that is of these slides in particular, much of this information is provided in the handout that you received. There's some other information that is not in there, however, which I'd be happy to provide to anyone. This gives you a breakdown of their ages. They're fairly young, but not a really young group. 10% are over 50, as you can see. 70% are in that sort of middle range of 25 to 49. This was a piece of information that we found particularly interesting and somewhat poignant, because you can see that there's a difference between the number who report having children and the number who report having children with them. They are 78% reported that they had children under the age of 18, but just 68% had children with them in the shelter. Spent some time talking about this and would love to hear some of your reactions during the comments, but it seemed to us that probably this is a reflection of some of them having older children who might be able to stay with friends or other family members and stay in the same school. In some cases, the shelter resident may not have had custody of their children, and so while they have children, they do not have custody of those children, and so they are not with them. And there may be a host of other reasons as well. This provides information about the sexual orientation of the respondents in the study, 93% heterosexual or straight, as you can see. The others were often sort of culturally specific designations that that described a different kind of sexual orientation. Or in some cases, they said that because of the abuse, they no longer felt like they were sexual at all and that they had lost the sexual parts of themselves, and so they didn't claim an orientation in response to this question. So we do have qualitative information that does explain some of these findings. This gives you a sense of the education level of the survivors. 27% have not yet graduated from high school. You could say it that way. You can say, well, 56% have a high school education or less, or you could say 44% have some school or training beyond high school. All different ways to look at that particular piece of information. Okay, now we're getting to the responses from the survivors themselves. And this tells how they heard about the shelter. Number one being a domestic violence advocate, but second being police. These are the most common sources of information. There are many others, which I can provide for you. 34% provided two or more responses to this question. So they may have heard from multiple sources. 26% had heard from police and or court, put that together. So that raises it a bit more. But mental health, health care, flyers, church, child protective services, and welfare services were other primary sources of information about the shelter. This describes when the survivor had heard about the shelter, and there's sort of an interesting potential set of stories just to for this particular piece of information. You can see that 27% had first heard of the shelter more than a year previously. Well, it's not just because they had stayed in the shelter before, although that was true for 54% of that particular group. So a little over half had stayed in the shelter before. For others, it may have been a reflection of a fair amount of safety planning, looking at resources, planning when will be a good or a safer time to make the move into a shelter. Clearly, 25% who had first heard of the shelter within a day or two of getting there, that's a reflection of a very immediate crisis and not a lot of advanced planning or investigation of resources. So of the total that we talked about, nearly a quarter had stayed at the shelter before, and the majority of that group, it had been at least a year since they had stayed in the shelter. This looks a little bit more specifically at people who heard about the shelter from either the police or from court staff. They were more likely to be Latina or Caucasian. The other women of color, the African Americans, Asian and Pacific Islanders, Native Americans, and multiracial folks were much less likely to have heard about the shelter from people in police, from either the police or people in court. They were somewhat more likely to have heard a long time ago, and they were more likely to have stayed in the shelter in the past. Interestingly enough, just one of the men in our study had heard about the shelter from someone, from the police or from someone in court. It also suggests that perhaps the people who have known about the shelter for a longer time and who have been engaged in help seeking for a longer period of time have been more likely than the others to have also included criminal justice system contact. We also learned that 9% of the survivors had tried to stay in the shelter before, but they hadn't been able to do so. Overwhelmingly, that was because there was no room at the time that they tried. But there were also other reasons, and most of that had to do with information or eligibility issues. As many of you know, there are eligibility criteria that some shelters have that include not admitting teenage sons or concerns about medication. And so some of those come from liability concerns, and there may be a host of other issues that are involved with reasons that in the past someone may have not been able to come to shelter. A full quarter of the people reported that they had concerns about coming to the shelter. These are the types of concerns that they reported. This is stuff that we coded from an open-ended question. And so most of it having to do with not being familiar with the shelter. But the next one I'm going to show you are some examples that illustrate those types. Of the people who said they had concerns, 95% provided some elaboration about their concerns, and these are some examples from what they said. You can see they didn't know what to expect, concern about feeling judged, fear of their own, about the potential for their own safety while they are there, concern about deportation or child custody, and then rural issues, small town, not being private. So that really is a good illustration of the range of reasons that they had concerns about coming. We also asked them what they would have done if the shelter didn't exist. And again, these are our categories. You can see we put them into basically five different categories. But again, those are the researchers collapsing the categories, and I think that the one of the strengths of this study is that there were a lot of qualitative opportunities for people to describe, and so I'm going to ask my two colleagues to provide some voices that provide illustration of quotes from the survivors who responded. What would you do if this shelter didn't exist?
Be at a homeless shelter or begging friends to stay with them and putting them at risk of abuse by my ex-boyfriend.
Continue to run and move from place to place and constantly watch my every move, wondering if he's around.
Perhaps I would continue putting up with the bad life I had with my abuser. In a few words, resign to live like this.
I'd be sleeping in my car, lose my children and my job.
Probably I would have been killed because I had no place else to go. If I would have stayed with my other half, I would have been killed most likely.
We asked them about their entry experience, and you can see that by and large their entry experiences were really quite positive, especially the responses of staff made them feel welcome, treated them with respect. A little bit less high marks for the space felt comfortable. A little bit less than that, it seemed like a place for people like me. And least likely was an indication that the other residents made them feel welcome. Now, of course, it is not the job of shelter residents to welcome newcomers, and we know that. But we did want to have a sense of what that initial experience was like, because it can provide an influence over subsequent experiences. For the researchers in the room, these categories are a result of factor analysis. And so they are the categories of what survivors wanted at entry. We had 38 different items that we asked them to respond to individually. And 97% said they needed some kind of support. You might think it would be 100, but it was 97%. These included such items as emotional support, learning about their options, making connections to people who could help them, help understanding domestic violence, reconnecting to their community, help leaving their relationship, and obtaining counseling. So you can see those are the most prominent and the most frequently indicated. Economic help was way up there, and that was this was done actually before the major economic downturn that this country's been experiencing. We finished collecting data in March of 2008, so it was just before. Things were beginning to get a little nudgier, but it wasn't at the current level of crisis. And you can still see that it was very prominent. 61% needed at least three of the five types. This included a job or job training, safe and affordable housing, opportunities for school for myself, help with transportation, help with budgeting. Help with regard to their children involved was indicated by by 87% of the mothers. That involved safety for my kids, school for my children, counseling for my children, help learning to respond to upset children, and help with children's health issues. And criminal justice system needs, we just had three that were specifically related to the criminal justice system. Just over a third needed one of those kinds of help, and that included help with a restraining or protective order, help dealing with my abuser's arrest, and help dealing with my own arrest. There were also other clusters, and one that could be noted was help with health issues and benefits. And that had to do with their own health issues, their disabilities, help with TANF, and help with other government benefits, and help with their own physical injuries. This is the top 10 looking individually. So you can see it the highest is 85%. So the top 10 goes down to 66% for safety planning. The average number that was selected out of the 38 was 14. So people came in with multiple and complex needs. A few others that would be worth noting, a job or job training, 57%. Help with transportation, 52%. Help with leaving my relationship, 49%. So just under half. Help with my abuse-related injuries, 27%. Help with my disability, 19%. And help with immigration-related issues, 7%. I did pull out a couple that related in particular to the legal system, not just criminal justice, but legal system, and those were the indications of those needs. Note that all except for help with my own arrest were significantly higher for people who had heard about the shelter from the police or from court staff. We have some information, particularly about what the mothers wanted. These are the needs related to their kids. And all of these items, this is all of the items for mothers of children. None of the men who responded to the survey reported needs related to their children. We're getting closer to the sort of the shelter two now. This is the second form. The Average length of stay was 33 days. Range was 1 to 624. And yes, there that really was 624. We did say, okay, must be a typo. We called the coalition. The coalition knew where it was able to, by code, identify the program, called the program. Yes, we did have someone who stayed for 624 days. That's worth noting. The median length of stay was 22 days. For mothers, was 27. If you look at that in a different way, 63% stayed up to a month, and 14% stayed over 2 months. One of the things I did not report, which I should have, is that when we asked the programs about their policies, 18% had by policy that they could not stay, the maximum length of stay was 30 days. And 21% of the programs reported that the length of stay, the maximum length of stay, was established by their funders. So just as a bit of context there. This provides you with some information about who wanted a particular kind of help and who got it. The way to read this is safety for myself. And this is at Shelter 2, 98% said they wanted help with safety, 91% got all of the help they wanted, 8% got some of the help they wanted, so that means that there's 1% who said, I didn't get any help with this, and I wanted it. So that's the way to read it. One of the things for those of you who are particularly attentive to all this litany of numbers here, is that, gee, these numbers seem to be substantially higher than you reported before. And that was a very interesting and consistent finding that we found that at point two, a substantially higher percentage of people wanted each of these items than they did at the point of entry. When they were closer to crisis, when they were less likely to be aware of what available services there were, when they, at this point, they've had more time to reflect on what they need in order to be able to create a safer life for themselves. It's consistent with the one other study that looked at this particular issue in Canada, where the needs at the end point, at the exit point, were dramatically higher than they were at the entry point. In general, the longer someone stayed, the more likely they were to get the help that they wanted. This looks at the same sort of information, particularly for legal system issues. And you can see that they are not quite as high as the others, but they are still quite high. If you add them up across, 91% got at least some help with a protective or restraining order, 82% with their abuser's arrest and their own arrest. And looking at mothers, child protection system issues, 90% got at least some help, and 83% got at least some help with custody and visitation issues. These are the short-term self-reported outcomes. This is the way they were stated, and you can see that they are really quite positive. They involve categorically thinking that they got information, they gained confidence, they gained a sense of agency, that they can do things for themselves, and they feel more hopeful. One of the consistent findings. I might also point out that two of these items are now being used by the FIPSA office and are being required as reporting for all the funded shelter programs across the state, and that is, I know more ways to plan for my safety, and I know more about community resources. And those are selected in part because while this is clearly not a controlled experimental design, one of the major controlled experimental design studies found that people who had more information and more knowledge of resources had better longer-term outcomes. They were safer, they had greater well-being, they had better connection with their community, and so this is particularly important in that context. As for the children, the mothers reported about their children that they believe their children feel more supported, have more understanding about what's been happening, and are better able to express their feelings without violence. I did bypass some of the voices. And so let's back up. What the survivors said about the overall, because of their shelter experience, how they're feeling.
One woman said, "Being here has helped me develop a sense of worth, knowing I don't have to take abuse of any kind from anyone.
I am more confident in my decision-making process. I can count me thanks to all the trained professionals here at the Safe Place. I changed myself, but I had a great deal of coaches. I feel happy that someone had thought of abused people and founded a shelter to protect us and teach us that we have worth as human beings. Thank you for the support.
Since I've been staying in this shelter, I went from slamming dope to clean and sober. Thank you.
I feel like I'm a new person, and my standards are much higher in every aspect of my life now. I'm ready to live again."
And from the mothers about their children.
"My children know now that we don't have to live in fear.
Because of separation from my abuser, as well as my experience with a particular counselor, I can already see a change in my daughter's concepts of her personal power and women's empowerment, and her pride in me has grown greatly."
"My son went from being in learning disabled to high honor roll student. More goals were achieved by both of my kids here than ever in their life before this."
Okay. One of the notable things about this study is that we asked about other kinds of experiences as well, and about the problems that they had encountered, their conflicts, and the source of them. And you can see that conflict with other residents leads the list as the most commonly encountered problem, although notably nearly three-quarters of those were resolved. This is actually the top half of the 18 specific items. These are the most common, the 18 specific items. 10 of those were related to rules, and 8 related to other kinds of issues. You can see that the next 3 really have to do with resource issues, whether it's resources within the shelter or resources based on just capacity and in being able to provide the service. So there's quite a range. Choices of food, sometimes it just wasn't good. Sometimes it wasn't culturally appropriate. Sometimes there was concern that there was not food that was particularly useful for people who might be pregnant. Some of the child discipline issues had to do with other residents disciplining their children. So a lot of it has to do with issues of group living that certainly staff are quite familiar with. This gives you an indication of what they said about the support and respect shown by shelter staff, and this is the strongly agree. If you add in the agree, the range of responses is 98% to 92%. So we're reporting the strongly agree. And I have asterisked the bottom 3 because we did some particular comparisons. We looked at people who identified as heterosexual and those who had other identification as far as sexual orientation, and the percentages were the same. Caucasians compared to people of color, the response was the same. And people who were under 18 or 65 or older compared to the rest, the response was the same. So I think that is a powerful testimony. And here's the overall rating. Very, very helpful or helpful, 94%. And we'll give you some sense of just a couple of quotes from survivors on this.
I want every woman to be safe. I'm here because I'm 21 years old and my boyfriend tried to stab me to death. He beat me so bad one time, all I could feel on my face was blood. But because of this shelter, I am alive today. So be safe and God bless.
I was able to get a good night's sleep without thinking about who and when will come through the door and how. I wish there was a halfway house or shelter to go to after my stay here.
When you think of asking for help, you're the only one in that situation. They're going to laugh at you. But when you arrive, everything is different. They respect you as a person, as a woman, as a mother, and above all, they let you know that you have a lot of options and that you don't have to live in a situation you don't want to. Housing, food, and respect. There is everything here. They're all understanding and very respectful, and above all, they listen and don't judge you. God bless you. You have saved a lot of lives, and mine too. Thanks.
So in general, we concluded, in fact, that shelters do address a compelling need not met elsewhere, that survivors don't turn to shelter as a first resort. Sometimes people think that it's that there are other motivations, but this study speaks to the concerns and the fears that many people had before they came to the shelter. It also demonstrates that programs respond to diverse people and a wide range of kinds of needs. We also learned that the primary needs that were expressed by survivors in shelter are very basic ones. Safety, information, help with the children, help with the emotional stress and trauma that they've experienced, and help connecting to or creating economic resources. Now, this was not necessarily true across the board, but shelters actually meet most needs for most residents. Definitely exceptions, but this, as a general pattern, was borne out. That shelter staff help to resolve most of the problems that arise. Sometimes the problems that arise are beyond their control because of resources, and other times maybe they need some more training related to conflict resolution or other kinds of issues, but they resolve most of the problems that arise. And that survivors rate their experience quite highly and say that they have changed as a result of their time there. Clearly, resource challenges do remain an issue. Mothers' concerns about their children remain primary for those who are mothers. There's evidence that continued staff training and conflict resolution is very important and would be useful on an ongoing basis. Given the concerns about eligibility and the prior experience of not being able to get into shelter, there are some shelter rules and eligibility criteria that in some circumstances warrant further consideration, and that language and cultural competence remain crucial. So I'd like to turn this over to Anne Menard for some additional